I am Paul Rooney. I'm with Waterways Council. We've got a PowerPoint I'm going to utilize. I don't know if I can get it up here through the remote or have some technical help.
Great.
Number one. I'm with the Waterways Council. We're the national public policy organization advocating our inland waterways and ports. I'm a registered lobbyist. We work in government affairs. So this is going to have a little bit different flair than most of the things you've seen today. I work with policy, legislative action, and policy. And next to Doug Bunny and Catching the Fish, those are the things I look for. Bob made some great cases about the wonderful asset we have with our inland waterways. But unless we have policy that sets that up, all those market opportunities that the Panama Canal, for instance, will allow us are going to go untapped. And we're in a situation with our inland waterways that, well, since we're in the home of stockyards, I'll use an ag reference. We've been milking the same cow in St. Peter for decades. And that's where we are with our inland waterways. Our priorities, Waterways Council priorities, include funding for the infrastructure projects, operation and maintenance needs, construction of rehabilitations of these structures, many of which are 80 years old, and also new construction of locks and dams on our inland waterways. A lot of this Bob covered. It's a great success story. We're kind of like the other ugly stepchild of the transportation matrix, which isn't fair to stepchildren or other people, but that's kind of the way we feel with waterways. Attracts billions of investment dollars in the plants and the equipment on land side, creates and supports millions of sustainable family wage jobs, construction jobs, critical energy supply lines, keeping our industries competitive in the global market, especially for Missouri agriculture. When you look at the exports that go down our inland waterways and how Brazil and Argentina has caught up with the United States with respect to our ag exports, probably the only positive balance we have in our international trade. It's a little scary how we're letting the opportunity pass us by with respect to the waterways. Waterways set the baseline rates for rail and truck. Sure, all of you know that. It's environmentally superior, reducing pollution, conserving fuel usage, and it moves about 14% of all intercity freight for only 3% of the total freight cost. The commodities moved on the waterways, I won't go through all of these, but there you can see how it's broken down. The building blocks of our nation's economy, essentially. That waterborne commerce, over half of it's foreign trade, 41% of it being domestic. Our ports and waterways infrastructure handles about 2.5 billion tons of cargo annually. Especially the foreign trade, critical oil imports, agricultural exports, consumer goods. Was back in the early 90s, the foreign trade surpassed the domestic waterborne movements. It's absolutely critical to our economy, and yet we don't really hear about it in the news every day. Real brief breakdown on what was going on in the river last year. For the third consecutive year, we actually added barges into the American fleet, and 935 barges retired, but over 1,000 new barges came online. That total is about 18,000 dry cargo barges on our inland waterways, with an average age of about 16 years of those barges, almost 3,000 liquid cargo barges, averaging almost 22 years. Real opportunities and strong markets for both the liquid and dry barges last year for the movers of those barges. It was a great year for shippers, and especially the producers. It was maybe not such a great year because of the tight supply, especially in grain barges as a result of the barge shortage. It used to be that northbound barge tows carrying barges empty up to the Midwest. Now, just about all of them are full of something, and typically input for either ag or manufactured materials. Some of the other issues that we saw, supplier and labor costs escalating well beyond the inflation rates. Always an issue is the intermittent and unscheduled closures of our locks and dams that Bob has mentioned. I'll talk a little more detail about that. And then last year especially, we had some real issues with Mother Nature, with flooding on both the Ohio and Lower Mids in the spring. In the summer, we had flooding on the Upper Mids and Hurricanes Gustav and Ike in late summer. The covered bars, the grain bars, as I mentioned, one interesting thing about last year, the supply and demand for those bars is, according to the Informed Economics report last year, the covered bars pressure index doubled from 2004 to 2008. Some of that being eased a little bit by the ethanol situation, which I'm not going to get into too much detail, but I can answer questions about it if we have a little more time. Looking ahead as far as what's on the river, I think we're going to continue to see this economic crisis, and especially with respect to the river, we didn't see that as much last year, but that's going to trickle down in the East River operations this year as the world economic and financial crisis continues. Especially with automotive, the housing market slow to rebound. A lot of those products moved by barge and the input moved by barge. One interesting thing to look for is the impact of the economic stimulus on the shipping of those construction materials, as the stimulus dollars are supposed to be going towards construction of an infrastructure, how that will play out on the river. Barge availability and steel prices. You know, for several years we had sky-high steel prices prior to 2009, which is part of the reason why old barges were being retired at such a quick rate. Any available barges were in high demand, and I think we're starting to see a slowdown, a change-up of that. But that was certainly a factor last year. And that and ethanol, I guess, were two of the biggest things as far as the shippers go that they were talking about, the ethanol impact on river exports and river traffic, and other typical continuing challenges as far as trade policy go. Some of the policy issues, and this is we're starting to gear up and what I wanted to really talk about, the capital improvements that we're meeting on the inland waterways, policy issues impacting that. We've got an inland waterways trust fund that I'll talk about in a little more detail a little bit later, but that has reached a critical mass as far as its sustainability. It helps us fund capital improvements, it's a cost share, diesel tax that the movers of our barges pay, and that gets transferred down the transportation costs to the shippers. The question of earmarks, just about anybody who's read the paper or been online has heard about this issue in D.C. as far as earmarks goes. Earmarks, by the strictest definition, is anything not in the administration's budget. It's a plus-up, an add-on that Congress puts into the budget bill that they pass. And I'll talk a little bit more about that a little later. We've also got the administration last year proposed a new barge tax that we spent quite a bit of time dispelling and debunking and explaining why it was particularly onerous for any states that have a river with locks on it, like Wisconsin, Minnesota, Missouri, for sure, Iowa, Illinois, and so on. I can talk a little bit more about that as we go through this. And I want to jump down to the one on the bottom. This might sound more of politics, but it really is. It has policy implications with Senator Bond choosing to retire, particularly for the river folks, because he's on the Energy and Water Subcommittee of the Appropriations Committee. Big asset to our project that we care about, and other policy aside from just the funding and appropriations, policy regarding the Missouri River and how it's being utilized. And we've got this water war connected to the drought with the Missouri in respect to shipping and flood control versus recreation and Endangered Species Act. And so I think that we'll really see the impact to Senator Bond's retirement. Some of the challenges, Ernie asked me to talk about the challenges of the waterways. It's a little bit like asking what it's going to take to get Kansas City Royal to be a contender. We've heard a lot of things, and this is going to feel like turning through a fire hose for a second, so please bear with me. But some of the challenges we have with our inland waterways, the infrastructure appropriation levels. We've got serious issues over the last several decades with operation and maintenance funding, rehab funding available to the infrastructure. Essentially, Congress has seen fit to, without a transportation policy, both overall among the three modes and within water itself, we've been enjoying the benefits of a walking river and the dams without putting the money in to keep it moving without compromise. And not just the dollar amounts, but the way that we appropriate dollars versus the construction of those capital improvements, with unreliable funding streams and schedules that really wreaks havoc with the engineers that work, the Army Corps of Engineers, in trying to keep these locks really, frankly, just operational. Strategic expenditure by the Corps, the funds that get appropriated. Waterways Council and other groups are having dialogue among the Corps and other federal groups on priority projects for operations and maintenance, also known as OM, the rehab, new construction. We just got the 7 new locks for the Upper Mission, Illinois, authorized at the end of 2007. Those are going to be joining the queue of existing construction, and you'll see the backlog in a minute. Looking at an improved project delivery from the Corps on project completion. We'll see probably another higher tax or new tax proposal for the Inland Waterway Trust Fund within this year, and the issue of the trust fund itself, the sustainability of the trust fund, it's a cost share, as I mentioned, 50-50 for capital improvements, so half of all of the funds to rehab Lock and Dam 11, for instance, comes from this fuel tax. The other half comes from the general treasury that Congress appropriates, and with a growing backlog of projects in need of rehabilitation because, in part, of the underfunding that we have on the operations and maintenance side, that trust fund has really been under attack. Some other noteworthy challenges, I mentioned the Missouri River, the impact of dropping water transportation as one of the shipping options for the Missouri River Basin. Just hydrologically, 60% of the water of the Missouri 60% of the water of the Mississippi River south of the confluence of the Missouri is Missouri River water. If this country were founded west to east instead of vice versa, probably the lower Mississippi would be called the lower Missouri River just because of all the water that it runs into and the Mississippi relies on the Missouri River, especially in the summer and early fall. The impact on the Missouri, I really think Missouri River is the canary in the coal mine, and with respect to water transportation, river politics that have been going on continue to go on for the last decade, and in part because of the drought we've seen for the better part of a decade, but also with policy, the Missouri is one that we're watching closely, and also the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, also known as Mr. Go. I'm not sure anyone here is familiar with Mr. Go. It's a 76-mile channel, providing a shorter route between the Gulf of Mexico and New Orleans Inner Harbor. It's about 8 years old. It's essentially the single chamber provides a shorter route than the Mississippi River, and it's also used for deep draft vessels that can't fit through the canal locks down there and the industrial canal. The Inner Harbor Canal is the only way to get out of the port of New Orleans. And in the water bill at the end of 2007, Congress saw fit to deauthorize the Inner Canal as a priority for the Corps of Engineers. So we are in a situation that the only access to get out to New Orleans now is an 80-year-old single flat chamber. Does anybody else have a problem with this? So we're working with the Corps to try to understand how those real-world implications, if they do act on that without further study, are going to play out. Essentially, Mr. Go was part of the blame for Hurricane Katrina with respect to not slowing down the hurricane as it came through New Orleans. Still more challenges, right? You have some challenges, and your challenges. The preparedness for industry trends and innovations, like Bob was talking about with Panama Canal. The market opportunities that are there, but we don't have the policy, and certainly don't have the infrastructure to take advantage of them. We've got a growing world population. That is an undeniable truth, that with respect to the best population, they're most likely going to have more advanced diets requiring more ag imports from the rest of the world. We can be that provider, or it can be Brazil or Argentina or other parts of South America or other parts of the world. We've got the ability to do that. We don't have the infrastructure with respect to transportation to do that, either in rail or certainly in water. Increases our exports, which is great, but the river is shared by recreation boaters and commercial vessels, and so that is a challenge for the operators. Aging infrastructure is what I've been talking about. Frequent closures for repairs, the reliability question, and also the question of availability to move products and the delays that impact costs on moving product because things like you see there, leaking gates and so forth. This was done in Gore's Progress Administration, 1930s construction for the people to work, create a marine highway, a third coast to move products north to south and south to north. Concerns about reliability. There you see some of the major locks and dams that have required emergency repairs through the period of November of 2002 and July of 2007. We've got an O&M backlog that's created a fix-as-fail non-policy in this country, essentially because of the underfunding of the operation and maintenance of these structures. They then fall into a category that require rehabilitation, which is where the trust fund comes in, and it's been sapping the trust fund because so many of these things have been required rehab. It's just like a car, you know, you don't put oil in your car, you make that road trip, and maybe the next one after that, increasingly you have more expensive, more serious issues with your automobile. And it's the same thing with our locks and dam system. The funding infrastructure construction, I guess the takeaway on this is projects that were authorized in the 1986 Water Resources Development Act took an average of 6.3 years to go from start construction to an operational lock. Okay, with an average cost overrun of 32%. Since 1986, projects to go from start of construction to operational has jumped to a 17-year average with 110% cost overrun. We've been getting less for our dollar over the last several decades, and that's a really dangerous precedent that's been set. So we're working with the Corps to try to figure out exactly how we can improve on that delivery system. Part of it is the dollars that come into the Corps of Engineers, and part of it is the way that it's spent. And for a variety of reasons, some of which include these emergency closures I'm talking about. If your O&M budget has to go into emergency closures and you're spending more money than you thought on that, Corps constantly chasing its tail. Redirection away from the original navigation priorities of the Corps of Engineers is another reason. And just simply the dollar amounts that come in. The FY09 budget for the Corps of Civil Works was less than 0.2% of the entire federal budget. That's a round-off error in the DOD budget. It's a very minuscule amount. People have a perception that the Corps has a huge budget, and with respect to $70 billion in backlog projects, it really is a relatively small amount. And one of the other, I'll go back to one of the other things we're looking at is the ideas of cost sharing. Navigation has been paying for half of the locks and dams, but certainly you're not the only beneficiaries. You talk about hydropower, water supply, recreation, and other uses of the river that don't currently pay anything for a lock and dam system. I want to talk to you a little bit about two examples on what I've been discussing over the last 7 minutes. First one is Olmsted lock and dam, how not to plan and fund infrastructure. It was authorized in 88, a planning that began 8 years prior to that. The cost now has exceeded three times the original estimates for it, with a price tag of 2.1, and it's probably going to be closer to $3 million by the time it's finished. I was there last fall. It is still a brand new structure. It's got the lock chamber. The dam is not finished yet. The control panel for the lock is brand new Windows 98. Still got the covers over the monitors. It looks like a time machine. Go back 10 years. They're probably going to need a rehab before that lock even opens. They're going to need to do a major rehab of the lock before it even opens up. That's the first one. The second one is, you may have been aware of the Upper Mississippi River. I call it paralysis by analysis. The navigation study of the Mississippi River, darn near 20 years to study the thing. Finally, study was finished and we got word of Water Resources Development Act to authorize it in November of 2007. Two classic examples of what's been holding up moving forward on our infrastructure. Thirdly, a lack of spending for several decades for three reasons, more or less. Intense attacks by the Corps of Engineers on groups that espouse the environmental groups. Congressional apathy and administration apathy for river transportation because it seemed to be, well, barges are moving fine and we don't see the demand for going out and rushing and fixing the infrastructure. And then the third one is the Corps spreading resources to other missions and really Congress directing the Corps to spread resources to other missions like recreation and environmental cleanups and so on and so forth. The benefits foregone from construction delays, constrained funding has led to delays that exceed almost $8 billion because of the construction delays we've seen. Major navigation projects underway that cost share with the trust fund. I mentioned the attacks by the environmental groups and the Corps moving to other projects. Corps of Engineers is building septic tanks in West Virginia and Pennsylvania right now. They're building an amphitheater in Indianapolis, a Tulsa water taxi. All kinds of projects that are well beyond what the Corps of Engineers was originally and it's supposed to be doing. It's the number one federal agency for creative recreation opportunities. And folks, I'm a recreationist. I'm not against recreation, but we've got to remember that without a strong, vibrant economy, we don't have the luxury to be environmentalists or to enjoy the recreational benefits of the river if we don't take care of the infrastructure that we have that creates all of that water, creates all the opportunities for boaters and fishermen. Just a little bit about the trust fund, the connectedness to the trust fund and the funding with respect to project completions delayed, the revenue stream that is really impacted by shipping activity. You've got a lock and jam system that has been underfunded and frankly underutilized, and because of that we've seen the impact to the amounts in the trust fund. Very briefly on economic stimulus, how water shakes down, we're looking to get about $4.6 billion for river infrastructure, compare that with the $70 billion backlog that we currently have. That's evenly split between operation and maintenance and new construction, which includes new construction and rehabs. These are all shovel-ready projects. We don't get to know what projects are going to be. The Corps is still vetting which ones are going to get contracts right away, shovel-ready, all the things that Congress said the stimulus needed to the stimulus needed to meet. But we do know it's going to create hundreds of millions of man hours in construction jobs. But it really ignores the real problem here, which is the need for reliable, adequate, ongoing funding that can allow construction to keep moving, progress instead of the stops and starts that we see because of the annual appropriations process we've had this year. We just since October 1, I guess, the start of the FY09 fiscal year, we had a continuing resolution, then we had an omnibus approach bill, we had the stimulus bill. It's impossible for engineers to try to predict what they're going to be able to do because they don't know what money they're going to have. And that's a huge issue that we're trying to tackle with Congress. And really, this whole notion of a non-policy of transportation with respect to water, we've done this fix-as-fail approach for several decades, and that really needs to be fixed, because I think river transportation should be a major player when we talk about these larger issues that have become hot since the election. Climate change, energy independence, national security, American jobs. Water is well positioned on all of these. We came out with a list of shovel-ready projects that we think are worthy for the stimulus. One example, the Lower Mon 2 and 4. That needs $450 million with project completion of 2017 anticipated. It received $49 million in FY08 appropriations. Some of these are not going to be eligible. The Upper Miss new construction will not be eligible. The stimulus did not want to, Congress did not want to get into any new construction from stimulus dollars, which I understand because of the backlog, but just because your tires are bald doesn't mean you're going to ignore the pin going underneath the hood of your car. We're definitely advocating construction of new lots on the Upper Miss, and be it with the stimulus or into the next appropriations cycle. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know I'm standing between the field trip and and the reception. But I want to thank you all for letting me speak to you today.
So, we have a second question for Paul.
Yeah, Dave. Talk about the logjam and the equipment. How does that apply specifically to dredging?
Well, in a couple of ways. The dredging and maintenance, the operations and maintenance for us, number one, the funding levels aren't exactly what they need. Number two, to the core to plan what they want, where they want to dredge, or what kind of own emissions they need to resolve, they're not seeing any kind of a budget until now. We're almost, you know, at this point, 4 months, 5 months into the fiscal year before they can sort of see what it is that they anticipate on getting. So trying to predict what needs to be done, and more importantly, trying to predict the dollars they're going to get to do it for any given year, is darn near impossible. And what we've seen is you've got an emergency closure at Lock 27, for instance. So all the dredging projects or some of the maintenance issues the Corps was planning to do within a fiscal year at another site within the St. Louis District, for instance, now they've got to redirect dollars to pay for this emergency closure of Lock 27, which costs more than would have if you had fixed the problem through operation and maintenance at reliable levels and efficient funding levels, stops traffic and drives transportation costs up as a result of the lock being closed. You close one lock, the whole river is closed. You know, it's all interconnected.
Isn't there a surplus in dredging funds
that's
being
closed? You're talking about the harbor and maintenance? There is a surplus. The Harbor Trust Fund, and Bob, you can talk about this as well. As I understand, the Harbor Trust Fund is in a situation not unlike the Inland Waterway Trust Fund was 4 or 5 years ago, when we had $400 million surplus in the Inland Waterway Trust Fund. Part of that was because Congress wasn't appropriating dollars to address capital improvements of the locks and dams, and therefore we weren't taking any money, much money, out of the Inland Waterway Trust Fund. We've been able to get Congress to appropriate more dollars, which has brought more money out of the trust fund for the locks and dams. My guess is that's probably a similar situation with the Harbor Trust Fund.
Yeah, if I could amplify that a little bit. Recognize the Harbor Trust Fund is collected only on coastal ports. It's not collected on the Inland Waterways. The money initially, as Paul said, was collected to maintain the coastal ports. The problem we got into were several fold. And what really drove it was the environmental concerns about what do you do with the stuff that you dredge, the dredge material. Where do you put it? What does it contain? What's the environmental impact? As soon as the Corps ran into that problem, it slowed the whole process down because they had to do an environmental impact statement, they had to do an advanced analysis of the contents of the material, and they determined, then determined how they could safely dispose of it or store it or replace it. And as a result, that trust fund started growing because the Corps physically couldn't process the requirements fast enough to maintain the program. As a result, the Coastal Board just put it in. We've got a surplus of funds in that trust fund that can't be used for any other purpose. But if you're a member of Congress and you have to offset a deficit, one of the ways you offset a deficit is by having a balance in the various trust funds. So Congress really didn't have an incentive to solve that problem.
By the way, for the state here, the Great Lakes ports are coastal and within the definition of spot of use.
Can one or the other, or both of you, speak to some of the environmental concerns? The one thing that I've heard repeatedly from public policy folks when you mention maritime is, oh my God, the environmental consequence, whether it's dredging or placing dredge disposals or wakes or exotic species or, you know, the list seems endless.
You want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first. And at this time, could you pull up that second PowerPoint? I just want to show a couple of slides. There's a perception of the environmentalists and with respect to the river. A couple of things. First, with the invasive species, very little has anything to do with navigation. We've got the pallid sturgeon that anybody who follows the Missouri River, you're probably familiar with pallid sturgeon, endangered species fish, doing fine in certain stretches of the river and in other rivers, but within a 4-mile stretch, just below Gavin's Point Dam on the Missouri River, they can't find them. So now, Fish and Wildlife decides, oh my gosh, we've got to go and look and see if we can find some pallid sturgeon, and oh, wait a minute, we can't. So now we need to tell the Corps that they've got to redo their operations of the river, create this pulse mimicking a natural river twice, one in March and one in May, and so that it cues the spawning of the pallid sturgeon, which, by the way, we don't see it there anyhow. So now we're flooding the Missouri River in the spring when we don't need it, and we are holding river water back in the reservoirs in the fall when we do need it for navigation. Pallid sturgeon has been interbred with other types of sturgeon so much, I don't even know that biologists can identify too many true pallids because of their being with other sturgeon. Number one. Number two, the nice side benefit of the six dams on the Missouri River creating these reservoirs, side benefit has been recreation, fishing for South Dakota, North Dakota, especially. What do they fish for? Walleye. So you got walleye in the reservoirs that have access to the Missouri River. Who is the natural predator of the pallid sturgeon? The walleye. So there's no policy here. It's just absolute insanity. And without any cost-benefit ratios to go through, agencies like Fish and Wildlife and groups that espouse to be environmental groups can just make any kind of scientific claims and not have to put up or shut up. Whereas navigation has got all these hoops they have to go through with cost-benefit ratios and 20-year study from the Corps of Engineers and so on and so forth. I don't mean to, if anybody's from Fish and Wildlife, I don't mean to offend, but it really is frustrating when we're talking about Missouri River politics and policy not based on sound, proven science, but on what we think might work out with respect to one type of fish in one small section of the river. We're changing a whole transportation object because of it. What were the other questions with respect to endangered species? What I wanted to point out is we actually work really well with environmental groups, Nature Conservancy, Audubon, American Land Conservancy, Ducks Unlimited. We work really well with these groups on the Upper Miss program, because what we come up with for the Upper Miss is a dual purpose program for ecosystem restoration and transportation improvements. And one of the reasons why we work so well with them is when I show them these statistics about how environmentally friendly barge transportation is. You can't tell me that not utilizing this mode of transportation isn't good for the environment. And when people say, well, what about the river? I said, look, you can't afford to be a river environmentalist. That's not fair. You've got to take the whole ecosystem into account and be, air quotes, holistic about it and factor in the entire environment. If you're moving 15 barges, if you're moving that product by cargo 15 barges at a time, great. If you're not, you've got to move it somehow. You have to move it somehow. You've got a choice of rail or trucks. Neither of those are more environmentally friendly. So that's one of the arguments that we've been able to make some headway in with some of the environmental groups and get them to understand that, yeah, you know what, this is a pretty green and environmentally sustainable mode of transportation. I took up both of our times. If you want to address the question. And does that answer? Does that answer a little bit of the question?
I wanted to ask you if you could make a couple comments about short sea shipping and transportation on the equipment.
Can I do that first?
Yeah.
Short sea shipping, the way we define it is the premise behind it, ships in river, is to take products that are currently moving on highways and physically move them over to the waterways. I-95 is a classic example of a short sea shipping route. If you drove I-95, it's full heck of a lot worse than I-70. I mean, it's three out of four vehicles is here, trucks on it. What they're trying to do is to get those trucks, so the products that are moved by trucks, onto another way of transportation, free on I-95, to be a vehicle or, you know, something that we use cars on safely and efficiently. So that was the concept between short sea shipping. Can we move between one domestic port to another domestic port and take that product off of the truck primarily and move it while short? Short line rail, or we lost entirely, again, off the truck and put it on the water and get it moved more efficiently and more safely. I don't know, you look puzzled. I don't know if that quite answers your question.
Well, I just kind of want,
the Marine Highway System, believe it or not, was originally designed by I-95.
Okay.
That was the premise for the concept. And we looked at the concept and said, does it have any applications anyplace else? Yeah, it really has applications here in the Illinois Lakes. But again, what we're trying to do is to go from U.S. domestic port to U.S. domestic port. And there we get into a whole new set of laws called cabotage laws, which, you know, most of us here in the room don't have to deal with. But basically what that cabotage law says, and every maritime nation has a set of these, is that in order to preserve their ocean marine, they have a code of laws called cabotage laws that say if a product is moved from a domestic port in that country to a second domestic port in that country without going to a foreign port, you have to use that country's flag vessel, which means that vessel has to be produced in that country and has to be crewed by a crew from that country. So yeah, here in the inland waterways is a non-issue because everything we move is domestic port to domestic port. St. Louis to Minneapolis, St. Louis to Memphis, Memphis to New Orleans. Where you get into it is on the coast of Minnesota.
And just sell every other port, okay, we do.
we kind of ran into that about a year and a half ago, can you recall? Something about Dubai. Yes, sir.
I'm just curious, is the Corps of Engineers under the DOT umbrella, or what structure organizationally, where does it fit? Is that something that should be looked at?
The Corps of Engineers, the government is the one. Right now, I spent most of my life in the private sector. I just came to work for the federal government 14 years ago. So, you know, from my perspective, the federal government does a lot of smart things, but they do a lot of really dumb things too. You know, I don't know if you want to have a video back here. The Corps of Engineers is a part of the Department of Defense. The Coast Guard, which is the police force for the waterways, is a part of Homeland Security. The Maritime Administration, which is responsible for acting as an advocate for the American Ocean Marine domestically and in blue water, is a part of the Department of Transportation. You know, if you were to go back with a blackboard, you would probably redesign the entire government, put a lot of different agencies in different homes. But this is the system we have right now. This is the system we have to work with. And that's when you start running into the problem that Paul was talking about. You know, how do you allocate money to the Corps of Engineers to do certain projects that kind of bleed over into what the Coast Guard is responsible for, which kind of bleed over into what we're, as the Maritime Administration, is responsible for? There's no real thin cut lines, and it makes life a little more difficult to get an efficient system.
I think the only thing I'd add on that is, you know, the next question that's begged is, why is it that way? And the answer is because it's always been that way. The Corps was charged with navigation on the river. Forever, we had steamboats that had a lifespan of less than 2 years. They just snagged. And Congress and the administration decided, you know, we really need to do something about this. And so the Corps worked on all of that, and it was just natural that the engineers that were involved in the Army would do that. So they became the civil works portion of the Army, essentially. And as time progressed, they just stayed that way, and other things got piled onto them. Then now they're involved in having for a while in atomic cleanups, as EPA could do. So they asked the Corps of Engineers, can you guys handle the cleanup from all the atomic experiments that we did? One of the concerns, I think, if we look 15 years down the road, with respect to the Corps, if we don't continue to build for our future and they're only going to be chasing their tail with its operations and maintenance, they're going to end up in a category like Bureau of Reclamation. Bureau with a really minuscule budget compared overall and not able to do any progressive things. Corps is going to be in a similar situation, which is not good for the waterways, if indeed we continue to be funded under the Corps budget in the funding mechanisms with the annual approach, which, can we have a fiscal year matched calendar year? Is that such an odd notion that January 1 is the end of the fiscal year? So it all comes down to this, because it's the way it's always been.
You remember about 35 years ago, the feds moved their calendar to the fiscal year quarter, so they had more time to pass the budget. Anyway, getting back to Teresa's question, I'm not sure you quite answered it. I think the real answer to what she was asking was, how did Great Lakes fit into the notion of maritime highways?
Let me one quick thing about Great Lakes. With the turnover in the government and the minority becoming majority and vice versa, two big advocates of Great Lakes shipping came into power. One is Jim Oberstar, Congressman from Minnesota, House Transportation Infrastructure Committee Chair, and the second one is Dave Obey from Wisconsin, House Appropriations Chairman. So Great Lakes are in a better shape than they were previously. I don't know that I can answer any initiatives that I've heard of with my work with the Great Lakes, how it's connected to the Illinois River. Right now they're worried about keeping invasive species from getting further north. And so to the extent that we've got electric barriers in the Chicago region and so forth to try to figure out how to keep Asian carp from getting into that
spot. A good example of the Shark Sea corridor is the Shark Sea shipping route between Milwaukee and Chicago. You know, that just makes all sense. And there's a number of other ports in the Great Lakes where it's making sense also. And again, what we're looking at is what do we need to do to improve the interfaces to make it economically efficient and to make it functional.
What are we doing?
Yeah. Again, through Dark Spouse and Flight Virus up in the Chicago office, we're responsible for the Great Lakes. You know, they're working with state DOTs up there and identifying where the Marine Corridor should be and putting together coalitions up there. I would encourage you to get in touch with Mayor, get in touch with that, yeah.
Wondering if you've had any organized pushback against expanding freight
housing and the marine highways in the development community. I'm thinking about the Gulf and Atlantic intercoastal where I'm sure there's other examples that I think going on with where residential uses could come in approach that shipping lanes that are less used.
Yeah. We've heard of that not only there, but in Minneapolis, St. Paul. You know, that is another classic example where that's happening. What it's forcing us to do is to work with, of course, you know, for the ports themselves to start doing more comprehensive, sharp, long-term planning. The days of the largest regional ports along the inland waterways or the Great Lakes are pretty much gone because that land is very valuable and developers want to come in and start. So what you're going to see more concentrated areas of commercial development that's, you know, not there as a warehouse, but it's there because they have a water-land interface. If you don't have a water-land interface, there's other industrial parts where you really should be going. Traditionally, our port directors on the inland waterways have the chief of commerce executives. They're more concerned about bringing jobs and money and investment to the community. And if they have 10 acres to work with, and you came in and you made bulk roller barriers of some kind, and you wanted to be there because you wanted to have a view of the river, not because you were going to utilize it. You'd work like the devil to put you there so you had a view of the river in your office. You know, those things are going away. People are getting smarter and they have to. So yeah, that's an issue that everybody's coming to be forced to address.
I think we're going to have to close the session. I believe Randy is thanking me as well.